From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, it's The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, what last night's CMA Awards had to say about the status of women in country music. Then Tony Award-winning actor B.D. Wong steps off the stage and into the role of director for the play The Great Leap.
Play's fundamental question for me is the question of whether or not you will choose to be a person who makes movement, and there's a basketball metaphor here in the play, or one whether you will choose to be still.
And a pair of composers give a new series about Emily Dickinson, a decidedly modern sound. All that coming up on The Frame. Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. The CMA Awards are known as country music's biggest night. At the 53rd annual award show last evening, the stated focus was celebrating legendary women in country music. But for many fans of country superstar Carrie Underwood, who's also a long-running host of the ceremony, the night was a bit of a letdown. Here's Nashville-based NPR music critic Ann Powers.
The status of women in country music is a hot topic in Nashville these days, and it has been since 2015 when Keith Hill, who's a radio consultant, made some comments that gave rise to the phenomenon known as Tomato Gate or Salad Gate. He basically said that the reason that women were not often played on country radio is because they were the tomatoes in the salad of country music, just there for an accent. Unfortunately, the data backs up what Hill was saying. It's shocking how little they're played compared to men. So there's been a grassroots movement. Activist groups like Change the Conversation down here is a big one that have really fought back against this. And women are organizing. Women artists are organizing. And one way that people respond to these kinds of challenges is to mess with award shows. Because you know what, John? It's easier to mess with an award show than to mess with a radio format, sadly.
Yeah, I saw on the red carpet that Jennifer Nettles from the band Sugarland wore a cape that said, "Play our expletive records." Did that message carry out into the show in terms of what people were saying as they were picking up awards?
Oh, definitely. One high point was when Kacey Musgraves won for Female Artist of the Year. She gave a really heartfelt acceptance speech where she talked about how female energy is important, not just for country music, but for the earth right now. It was kind of like a Greta Thunberg moment. But, you know, that kind of vibe ran through the night in the way that the hosts spoke. The evening was hosted by three women. Usually it's hosted by Carrie Underwood and Brad Paisley, but instead of Brad, we had two legends of country music, Reba McEntire and Dolly Parton.
What do you call three women hosting the CMAs? Your lucky night!
And it definitely surfaced when women won awards. One or two of the dudes mentioned something too. I think Dan and Shay, the duo who won, I think they made a comment about how wonderful it was to see so many women performing.
Let's talk about some of the winners. Janae Fleener was the first ever woman to win a CMA award for Musician of the Year. She's a fiddle player. She's known for playing with Blake Shelton. How important was her win in terms of that category?
Janae Fleener's win is so important. No matter how visible and audible stars like Maren Morris and Kacey Musgraves are, what really is not changing or is changing far too slowly in country music, and frankly, throughout popular music, is this makeup of the bands who support these artists.
I want to ask you about another winner. Ashley McBride beat a couple of guys to win the award for New Artist of the Year. She had a debut album that did really well called Girl Going Nowhere.
And then the lights come up, and I hear the band, where they said I'd never be is exactly where I am. I hear the crowd, I look around, and I can't find one. Not bad for a girl going nowhere.
I am so excited that Ashley McBride won Best New Artist. The thing about Ashley McBride that's really powerful is that she appeals to the bread and butter country fan. She's not a Kacey Musgraves whose core audience is like cool millennials, you know. Ashley McBride is out there playing what I like to call flyover music, music for the heartland, and capturing the imaginations of that core country audience.
I want to ask you about an award that I think a lot of people thought a woman was going to win. Her name is Carrie Underwood, and it went to Garth Brooks again as Entertainer of the Year. It feels like he's won that, I think, pretty much every year since the Carter presidency. But what was it about Carrie Underwood that a lot of people were surprised that she didn't take that trophy home?
Wow, John, I have such complicated feelings about this. So Carrie Underwood, the most successful woman artist in the country format, the highest charting, most played woman on radio, put out a great album last year called Cry Pretty that pushed her in new directions. So yeah, everybody expected this to be her year, with the theme of the whole award show being women in country. And there's Carrie the whole time. I mean, I was shocked when Carrie didn't take that award. And I love Garth Brooks deeply. I truly do. I am a huge admirer of him in every way. I love his music. I love his live shows. I think he's a mensch. But I just want to say to you, Garth, you could have done a Macklemore. You could have done an Adele. When those pop artists won big awards that were expected to go to other performers, in the case of Macklemore, Kendrick Lamar, in the case of Adele, Beyoncé, they said something in their acceptance speech about that. Now, Garth did something interesting. He called out Reba McEntire's performance that night. She had performed her classic song Fancy. And he also called out Kelsea Ballerini, a younger woman artist who's really strong and moving up in the country world, and said, hey, you know, y'all are great and y'all deserve awards too. But why he chose to not say, hey, Carrie, this could have been yours, I don't know. There's probably politics I don't even understand there. But I wanted that moment and I didn't get it.
Ann Powers is a critic and correspondent at NPR Music. She joined us from Nashville. Ann, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Thank you so much, John. It was fun to talk about it.
Those memories of you still.
Coming up on The Frame, B.D. Wong moves from actor to director for a new play about basketball and international politics.
I'll always love you.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. B.D. Wong has made his mark as an actor in various settings. He won a Tony Award for his performance in M. Butterfly, on television with series such as Mr. Robot, and in films that include Jurassic World. But recently, Wong took on the role of theater director for The Great Leap, which is now at the Pasadena Playhouse. The play, written by Lauren Yee, is centered on a real-life basketball game between the United States and China in 1989, around the same time as the Tiananmen Square protest. The themes of the play, basketball and China, also have been very much in the news.
You feel like you've kind of hit the jackpot because you are doing something that is on the forefront of people's minds. The comparison, of course, between what's going on over there and the play itself is really, really relegated to politics and basketball and China. But those are three things that don't really you say in the same sentence all the time. So I don't know what I'm, you know, why I'm complaining.
If you were pitching Great Leap to an audience member, how would you describe what you want the play to do in terms of how they see the world or see themselves in it?
I'd say that I think the play, you know, at this time in our lives, as an American, really, as there's a lot of kind of political turmoil with our leaders and the kind of mess of the current administration. And that frustration creates a question in our minds about what it is that is our own responsibility, what it is that we choose to do, and whether we choose to step forward or not. And the play's fundamental question for me is the question of whether or not you will choose to be a person who makes movement, and there's a basketball metaphor here in there in the play, or one whether you will choose to be still. And that is a powerful question that you walk away from this play asking yourself, which character are you? Are you the one who moves or are you the one who stands still? And I have to say that we all in this audience thinks it is the person that moves, always. We always think we are that person. But when we really ask ourselves, we have to ask ourselves, at what level are we really that person? And to see the two characters in great relief in the same play who are struggling with the issue of that creates that question for us. So that's what I want them to walk away with, asking themselves that question.
What is it about San Francisco and about these characters' lives that you think is so important to reflect in terms of the Bay Area and what that city is like and what these characters' lives are like in that city?
Well, I think it's really wonderful when a playwright uses a specific time or place and explores the universality of her characters through that specific time or place. So when she describes these things, it strikes a chord for us who know the place, but it also strikes a chord because of its authenticity to anyone who doesn't know the place, because as it turns out, Lauren herself is from the Bay Area. And that's one of my touchstones with her, is that we're San Francisco Chinese Americans, and the San Francisco Chinese American vibe is very prevalent in this play. And so I feel a sense of a kind of understanding her in that way. And I love working on the play because of that. I always have from the beginning as an actor, but now as a director, kind of trying to imbue in whatever way possible my point of view as a person from San Francisco and a Chinese American. That's one of the more fun aspects of doing this particular directing job for me.
We're talking with actor and director B.D. Wong. You played one of the main characters, Wan Chong, who is the coach of the Beijing University team in two previous productions.
Yes.
When you step out of playing a character and are directing that character, what is that transformation like in terms of your perspective on the role and the overall production?
This is super interesting because... yeah, you know, it's a completely different point of view. You have a much more global view of the play, the production, and the other actors. And so for me, my intimacy with the character plays a role in my relationship with the actor playing the role that I once played, because I have a kind of shorthand with the part that allows me to kind of cut through some things that I have to be very careful about cutting through, because an actor should have his own process and find something out in his own time and in his own rhythm. But sometimes I can have insight into a moment. For example, one of the things that actors do in a play like Lauren's, which is written with a great deal of humor, is to try to find where the humor for that particular actor is. But I can also say, hey, you know what? I know for a fact this is actually really funny, so you should just like go for it.
But you have to be careful that you don't say, this is how I would have played it.
Oh, yeah, but I would never. If someone's actually says those words, which I think is something you'd see in a movie or something like that, I bristle at the idea of it.
The Pasadena Playhouse, like a lot of big arts institutions in and around L.A., has a core audience. That core audience, because I've been to a lot of plays there, is older and it's white. This is a play about a Chinese-American experience. So how do you make sure that you are authentic to a new audience, Chinese-Americans who are coming to the Playhouse, and also give what I'll call the older white audience a perspective into a story that they may not have access to any other way?
Well, it's humanity, you know. It's like illuminating humanity for a person of any color or any age is undeniable. And when you strike a chord emotionally or with humor, and Lauren does both of these in her writing very deftly, then you can reach anybody. I will also say, Lauren Yi is a bit of a kind of gateway playwright. She really can draw people into a seemingly specific storyline, location, and culture, and open it up through, like I said before, humor and emotion to make it seem completely universal. I mean, universal is a kind of a buzzword that people like to use, but it really is true that people can relate to the play because they're simply human beings and they have feelings and aspirations and dreams and disappointments, just like the characters in this play, regardless of their race or their age.
We're talking with actor and director B.D. Wong. Nina Jacobson, who's the producer of the movie Crazy Rich Asians, told me the story of shopping that movie around, was met with a lot of rejection, and in not one but two instances was told by a potential funder, does she have to be Asian?
Yeah.
The movie got made, but still there was that resistance to this idea that people wouldn't be interested or studios wouldn't want to finance a movie like that. How have you seen the evolution of the willingness in TV and film? I think theater is a little bit ahead of Hollywood in some regards.
Possibly.
To start challenging their own assumptions about what people will and will not show up for.
Yeah, I love that story that you've told that I have heard before. Because, you know, I really wish she would out these people and say their names.
I do too.
Because that's kind of shameful and couldn't be more ignorant. And clearly, as a result, has been proven to be very out of touch. So she dodged a bullet with those people because they didn't understand the value of what she had. You know, as far as how things have evolved, I do see, you know, having been in the business for many decades now, I feel the needle shifts and I feel a difference in myself and I feel a difference in my ease and interfacing with the industry and with my own career. And yet I still feel the same frustrations, partly because of conversations like this, or that stories like this that you've told. And I'm encouraged at the same time to kind of continue to kind of push the envelope, I guess, because the encouragement is greater than it was when I was first starting out. When I was first starting out, encouragement did not manifest itself in multi-millions of dollars in a, you know, it was a much smaller kind of achievement that you would take delight in. But now, this is a real kind of formidable contribution that Asian Americans are making to the mainstream media in a way that we haven't been able to do so before. So that's got to be encouraging.
And would you say there's a parallel development and opportunity and frustration with the way that stories about LGBTQ characters are told? Do they track each other? Is one ahead of the other? Or are they all part of the same conversation?
They're part of the same conversation, but they have their unique traits and their unique differences. And as a person who is a member of both of these communities, I feel similarities and the parallels in my life always. As an actor, I also feel the unique differences. And you know, the one thing that people often point out is that I can't really hide my Asian-ness. My Asian-ness is always here. And if I want to, I can hide my sexuality. And some people believe that that creates a different dynamic in the media when it comes to any number of issues that arise as a result of being part of these, you know, marginalized communities. They're just different. There's a lot of nuances that come into play because of that fundamental difference.
We talked about Crazy Rich Asians. We didn't talk about another movie that I think was a landmark, and that is The Farewell.
Yes.
With Awkwafina.
Yes.
And you're doing something with Awkwafina coming up, is that right?
I have shot the first season of Awkwafina's show called Awkwafina is Nora from Queens, a really funny show for Comedy Central, a half-hour comedy for Comedy Central, and had the time of my life doing that. That is airing in January. And really exciting about that because she is a force of nature. She's really, really having her moment, and rightly so, because not only is she extremely talented and appealing to just many demographics of people, but she is a very smart producer and a very smart generator of her own material and of her own community, and is very intentionally creating a kind of power situation in which women directors, women artists, there were just women everywhere on the set in a way that was so incredibly refreshing. And you realize that it takes a person to actually make it happen at this stage of the conversation.
BD Wong, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you so much. Thanks.
BD Wong is the director of The Great Leap. It's at the Pasadena Playhouse through December 1st. Up next on The Frame, the composers of the new Apple TV Plus series about Emily Dickinson give a modern spin to a classic story. I'm John Horn, and this is The Frame. Apple TV Plus recently launched with a slate of original TV shows, including Dickinson. It stars Hailee Steinfeld as the poet Emily Dickinson and the rapper Wiz Khalifa as the personification of death. Even though it's a period story, the soundscape includes contemporary pop songs and a bass-heavy score. The Frame's Jonathan Shiflett spoke with the show's composers about the first piece of music they submitted.
We did something so strange and so out there, and they were like, oh, we love it. And we're like, okay, I think this is going to be fun.
Yeah, we thought those main titles would be the first and last thing that we did on the show. Hi, my name is Ian Holmquist, and I'm a film composer.
I'm Jemin Lace, but you can call me Sophia, and I'm also a composer and a performer.
It was pretty random. Like, we had no idea it was coming in, and we just got a call from Apple, I think November of last year, saying that there's this new strange show about Emily Dickinson, but with kind of like a modern synth score.
And I think at first we kind of thought that they might have been pulling our leg because we were like, yes, hello, this is Apple, you know, like what? But turns out that I guess they really liked what they'd heard and thought that we would be good for the show because of our different sensibilities.
It was exciting. It was maybe a little intimidating just because a lot of the stuff that they were putting in as temp music or as like their inspiration is like really well-known pop music that's out now.
And produced by like three Swedish people in like months of time and thousands of dollars, you know, and we're like, how are we going to compete with this?
Yeah, so it was, you know, it was kind of a tall order to have a score that can compete with tracks like that, but then also live in Emily's world and be cinematic and like kind of carry all these different weights at the same time.
I'm madly in love with you.
Too bad.
Is there someone else?
Yes, actually.
Who is he? I'll kill him.
You can't kill him. He is death.
What?
I'm in love with death.
We can see some of the statistics of people listening, and actually there's one of the themes that's the death theme. And we keep seeing that that's the most Shazammed, and it's such a compliment because I think people think it's an actual hip-hop track, and then they find out it's us, and I love that. I wonder what people's reaction is to that.
One thing that we've kind of played around a bit on other projects, but it's never really been at the forefront, was using Sophia's voice as an actual instrument. You know, as like a different texture, just to kind of make it sound more interesting. And as soon as they heard it, they were like, wait a second, that's amazing. And now it's become like the biggest note we keep getting is like more Sophie vocals, more Sophie vocals. Her singing voice has really kind of become like the inner thoughts of Emily in a way.
I didn't really think about the fact that there could be this like further connection between the vocals and, you know, the way that she's feeling internally. And, you know, and voice is kind of something that's been used to express oneself since the beginning of time. And I feel like especially there's one, episode 9 has one called The Hour of Death, which is interesting because it starts off with being kind of within a setting where you would hear a vocal piece because they're in a church. But then by the end of it, she has an encounter, one of the many encounters with death, and it becomes like her eulogy in a way.
I felt a funeral in my brain and mourners to and fro.
I feel like we've worked together enough at this point where we've become really good at being critics to ourselves and trusting each other. So if someone says something's not working, we usually trust that. You know, I think at least once every project, there's always a bit of an explosion and maybe a door gets slammed or something.
But on the flip side, it also, I think that there's been times when if Ian started a cue and he's like, no, this is garbage, like, let's start from scratch, I'll go in and I'll be like, no, we can salvage this. And then it transforms into just something different. And that's why it's nice to have the two of us, because it's like, something that Ian or that I would have thought was a complete disaster at the beginning can evolve into something that actually works. We work at home studios, so we're literally in the same room for every single cue and every single moment, sitting at the same desk, and
we end up spending a lot of hours in the studio together.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been trying to get on almost like a 9-to-5 schedule lately, but it's just, you know, in this crazy world of scoring, like, it just, you might get an email full of 2 pages of notes at 10 p.m. that are due the next morning by brunch or whatever, so you just don't really have a choice.
You mean like what happened last night?
Yes, exactly.
There's a lot that I think needs to get caught up on, especially in the age of streaming, especially when it comes to the fact that it's so hard for us to release soundtracks as composers, and, you know, like, even in terms of, you know, royalties and...
There's a lot of questions in the air that or talked about every new project. It's like, so how are the rights going to work on this one?
Because I think once upon a time, people would be like, okay, well, the royalties are, you know, at least like for us, it's like we kind of talk about this all the time. Like, oh, to have been a TV composer in the 90s, you know, because you see all these like TV composers from the 80s and 90s. And it's like, welcome to my Malibu home with my like two studios. And meanwhile, it's like, I'm just excited that I get to make a live, like any kind of living doing this. But at the same time, it's like the same way that it is with Spotify and Apple Music and with all of these kind of like streaming platforms is that people just expect for things to be free. So when people expect for things to be free and when music is something that's so abstract, it's really hard to put a price point on it. Because, you know, if you're buying a painting, you're like, okay, well, I can see the materials. And whereas with us, it's like it's all just time. And how do you quantify time?
And that'll do it for today. Remember, you can follow us on social media. We're at The Frame. And also keep up with us with our weekly newsletter, which goes out every Thursday. You can sign up at theframe.org/newsletter. I'm John Horn at the Mode Broadcast Center at KPCC. We'll see you back here tomorrow.